Well, welcome. I'm Clara Jeffrey. I'm the co-editor of Mother Jones. This is Nick Bauman, our Washington-based news editor. And I'm just going to start by telling you what we're going to do here today. It's a panel about reported aggregation. And what we're not going to do is rehash the what is aggregation ethics fight, because for one thing, there's been some panels on that already, and there's one immediately following this. So what we are going to do is do a deep dive into one content form that gets around that fight and that covers big social news events in a way that honors reporting. And then we'll talk about similar forms that have taken place at other shops and get to a tech wish list and sort of where we see things going. And we'll leave a lot of time for Q&A for the throngs of people in this room. Okay, so to start, I'm just going to give anyone who doesn't know a little bit of background on Mother Jones, because the question of staff resources comes into play here. So we're a bi-monthly magazine originally founded in 76 with an emphasis on investigative reporting. We were actually the first general interest news magazine to have a website, 1993, but it sort of languished until about 5 years ago, where we hired a bunch of reporters, mostly based in D.C., and turned the emphasis of the organization to daily reporting. And you can see our numbers down below. We have about 200,000 print subscribers, and we have about 6 million monthly page views and 2.5 million uniques. That number has gone up dramatically in the last couple of years, and one of the reasons is the forum we're going to talk about now, which we call our reported explainers. So that's a nice little article from Neiman talking about the traffic bump that we got. But backing up a bit, we discovered this form right as this sort of Bill Keller, Arianna Huffington, pachyderm versus aggregator fight was sort of breaking into the news. And, you know, the conceit of that fight was there was sort of the old guard, daily newspapers, reporting shops that did the hard work of reporting, and the aggregators that then repackaged the reporting that somebody had done elsewhere. But that was always kind of a false dichotomy. I mean, the papers had already long since adapted a lot of the, that's from The Onion, thanks, had long since adapted a lot of the of new journalism's forms, and HuffPo has, you know, put a number of great reporters on its staff. So that's the sort of background of where we started. This particular forum, which came about during the Arab Spring. And I'm going to turn it over to Nick for a little bit, because he was the one who just sort of sat down one day and started to do it.
So we had this problem where the Arab Spring started, and there was this huge news event that everyone was talking about. And we, as a small shop, don't always have the resources or the money to send someone off to Cairo at a moment's notice. But we did want to cover it, and we did want to add value for our readers and sort of develop something that could work for us and for our readers. And I thought about how a lot of my friends, when they, you know, they may follow the news a little or they follow the news a lot, but sometimes something gets going and you don't really know how to get into it. You know, by the time you know about the story, so much has already happened that you can't, you don't have a way in. So first I started with what's basically an explainer. And you guys know what this is like. this is a Slate one. About fighting off a pack of hungry wolves, but I went really basic. I was like, where is Egypt? What's going on there? Why might people be unhappy? Sort of, you know, very, very basic stuff. And almost immediately after I finished writing that up, I realized this is already outdated. So I integrated sort of a live blog type thing. Updates every few hours about what was going on. There was so much coming out, like a real fire hose of information. I know that's a cliche. That we had to curate, and we had to break down who was reliable, We even decided to start doing some reporting of our own. We started calling up people who we knew in Egypt, calling up experts, and whenever we saw something that we thought was wrong or not quite verified yet, we tried to, you know, go the extra mile and do a little bit more reporting. We also integrated a lot of social media. Claire used the term earlier, social news event, and that's sort of what the Arab Spring was in a lot of ways. Twitter and Facebook and those sorts of things were very central to that event. And we brought in tweets and we brought in video from the internet. We have a lot of, we have subscriptions to various photo services. We tried to make it very visual. We even did some of this sort of, this is a bad pun, but Andy Carvin at NPR had been doing a lot of this using Twitter as a reporting platform to try and reach out to people. Obviously, the issue with that is making sure that people are real people and not fake people. We did some of that too.
And I think one of the interesting things about that is that we found the same to be true on Twitter almost. Like, you could watch Andy and Blake Hounsdell and other sort of people who were really covering the Arab Spring. But if you didn't have the background, it was hard to make sense of even what they were trying to do, even for journalists that could navigate that perhaps better than just regular people. So as we kept going, we would update the explainer and then tweet back out like, okay, here's our update and we've got the new information on what happened in Tahrir Square today, or what's going on with Mubarak's forces attacking these people here. And we found that readers really then started responding, and they were basically just thankful that someone had broken it down kind of all in one place with the background and the updates, which doesn't seem like a kind of hugely revelatory thing, but was a very necessary device that actually really hadn't happened so much anywhere in the past. News articles would tend to be separated from live blogs, and that background information and kind of links to additional resources were disaggregated basically across the web.
I'm just scrolling through some of the stuff that we did here. You can see their photos, there are a ton of updates, people talking to people. We actually ended up with something like 196 updates on this, but we went all the way through to a couple days after the fall of Mubarak, really kept it going for a while. We were sort of making it up as we went along, making up the form, and one of the things that we developed was every time that we had something substantial, that we were adding, we changed the photo, we changed the headline, we tweeted out, and we'd find people were sending, more information back our way. Oh, have you updated this yet? do you have this in here? Have you heard this? Is this true? And they were really looking to us to see if what they were hearing.
Which was really interesting. We saw that with the Arab Spring, but we've done a year of these now, and particularly when it came to domestic events like our Occupy coverage and the Wisconsin Union fight, we didn't even have to ask. People just sort of became a bureau of reporters sending us information that we would then verify and include in our explainers when it checked out.
And the explainers also, and obviously we're using explainers loosely because it's an explainer component with a live blog and reporting and also a lot of social media components. They can integrate reporting and they can serve as a portal to other reporting on your site. So you can see Ashley Bates, which is another staff member. Eventually, nearly everyone on staff became involved in explainers one way or another, to some degree. Talking about some of the African refugees who she called in Cairo to talk to them about what was going on there. And you know, just because you're doing aggregation or you're based in the U.S. or your organization can't afford to have you on the scene doesn't mean that you can't add value in terms of reporting. You can't talk to experts. You can't talk to people who are actually there. And one of the great things about Facebook and Twitter is that they enable you to get access to those people easier. We did run into some problems. Obviously, when you're working fast-moving event, you do make mistakes happen, and we tried to address that by making transparent sort of real-time corrections, sometimes little slip-ups like that. And then also, Clara talks about this bottom-up data as maybe like sort of a cry for help. We were investing a lot of time in this. It takes a lot of time to collate all this information, be doing reporting of your own at the same time.
Yeah, and I mean we're a pretty small shop. There are about 23 or so staff, reporter, and editors, and then 8 intern fact checkers who are invaluable to us. Was the first one Bahrain, or did we start with Egypt?
We started with Tunisia. But that did not have, it wasn't the sort of mature form of this because we didn't update it. It was more of a slate style, just a basic backgrounder.
But in any case, we had, all of the kind of major Arab Spring countries, and then sometimes we would restart an explainer because they had gotten out of date or too unwieldy, literally for load times. With hundreds and hundreds of updates. Then we started taking this into other forms of coverage. And, it became a real bandwidth issue for our staff. I mean, I remember one time saying, we should start an explainer on Solyndra. And the faces just fell in the edit meeting. It was like, please, dear God, we can't do another one of these. It is basically adding a whole nother job. I mean, the Atlantic Wire, which does a sort of more aggregation-based version of this. I mean, they sometimes do some original reporting, but basically it's aggregation. They now have 20 people on staff doing the Atlantic Wire. So you can see how if you try and combine this with all your other jobs, your multiple jobs you're already doing, it can become a real drain. So you just have to sort of think about it ahead of time. One of the things that we kind of quickly realized was that the perfect event would be something that was 1 to 7 days long, had a definitive end. But unfortunately, the news just does not work like that. So especially when it came to Egypt, we sort of went through the first big Egypt uprising and things then sort of died down for months, and then we kind of brought it back and then it died down. And so, it was a real learning experience in terms of how we would have to allocate staff time, and mostly reporters and editors, but also we had a lot of folks on the tech side kind of helping us through this, especially as we started to integrate some third-party apps. And I think just to back up, our the core of our brand is investigative reporting, so the proportion, if you're doing these in different kinds of shops, could be more aggregation to less aggregation. For us, it was really important to feature reporting that we had already done or were currently doing, or to at least make those sort of value-added phone calls to experts, and also to really point people to the Andy Carvins, the Blake Hansels, the Arabic bloggers and tweeters who were covering these events, and when it came to things like Occupy, to really show people like here's an array of sources, here's sort of where they're coming from, this is our take on it, but you might also want to check out what these people have to say.
Yeah, one of our very standard features in these explainers is very close to the top to point people in the direction of Twitter accounts, Twitter hashtags, bloggers, reporters, and other experts that they can go to for straight to the source, real time information on whatever whatever we're covering.
So I don't know how many of you were at South By last year. I wasn't, but you know, it was sort of Storify's big debut then. And so this Storify was kind of coming into its own just as we were doing this. So originally we were doing all of this in our CMS, which is Drupal, and like all CMSs, it has its issues. Storify was really intriguing, and they were just starting, and Bert Herman came in to talk to us about, because I think what it had mostly been used for at that point was aggregating kind of social media chatter about stuff that had happened. And it hadn't yet been so used to sort of do things in real time. So we talked with him about how, like, some of the features that we wanted, many of which they had developed but not yet released yet, and just sort of talk through how this could be better used by reporters in real time. So we started to use Storify on many of our explainers. One of the additional benefits that Storify had for us, we're in a collaboration with The Atlantic, Slate, Wired, CIR, PBS's Need to Know, and Grist,
Guardian.
And now The Guardian, called the Climate Desk, on climate and energy issues. And what was nice about Storify is we could quickly kind of pull the stuff that was related from all the partner sites and then other information, and I think potentially a way that multiple users can kind of contribute to the same thing in close to real time. We'll get to that in our wish list. But here you can see this is part of a Climate Desk Storify we did on Hurricane Irene, which, you know, was sort of perfect news event in its duration. Fortunately for, you know, the people on the ground, it did not turn into any kind of catastrophe, which meant it didn't quite take off as much as a news item. But it was a good first use of Storify. And then we also, you know, used Storify for a lot of other things, including rounding up the Occupy Sesame Street meme, which was fun and that we contributed to. Embedded tweets weren't around when we started, but they're also a way that we can do this kind of now can do, and this is from part of one of the debate coverages that we did, that we can use them in much the same way as you might use in Storify.
So we wanted to talk about a few examples of cool sort of aggregated reporting type things, things that integrate social media, integrate, you know, actually going out and doing the work of reporting, and but also rely on crediting sources and bringing different sources together.
So this is Al Jazeera's The Stream, which has a web presence and then a TV show. And they actually baked Storify's API right into their CMS. Is that the word I want in this instance? I'm not a technologist. But they kind of do this great social media integration into their website. And then when they do their TV show, they kind of pull all that right into the show and react to it in real time. And in a sort of much, you know, not just talking like Anderson Cooper reading a tweet from somebody. It's a much more kind of seamless integration of various kinds of media. And obviously, like, Al Jazeera was front and center in the Arab Spring stuff, so it, you know, it was the perfect kind of moment for them to try out all of this.
Yeah, you can see that we weren't the only organization sort of struggling to respond to this new kind of news event, this event that's really taking place as much. You know, as much of the action is happening online and, you know, on Facebook and Twitter as is on, you know, cable news or the broadcast news stations. And I remember just when the uprising in Egypt was first starting, one of the some of the best images coming out of there were from a webcam that someone had posted in his window near Tahrir Square. And no Western journalists had sort of been covering it yet, but you could watch what was going on through a webcam before even those first wire photos got out of the protests.
And also the way that social media, I mean, I think sometimes it can be overstated that social media caused these revolutions to happen. In my opinion, it's not so much that, but it's a reinforcing process where other people in those countries and outside learn of these things, and the stakes get raised, basically, because more people know about it. And so what we were trying to do was sort of bake that experience into our reporting, because if you just sort of wrote this abstracted piece that didn't kind of include that really visceral feel, it just didn't feel as honest to what was going on. So, you know, it's a new kind of narrative. It's a very sort of fragmented narrative in some ways. But I think it's, you know, it's like standing back from a impressionistic painting or something. You sort of get the sense of the whole. If you go up close, it can make no sense, which is why we were trying to integrate both the background to the sort of constant stream of information.
Yeah, that fragmentation was a really important part of why we integrated these sort of explainers that didn't just do, you know, your traditional live blog, you know, Egypt live blog, or, you know, what's the latest from X location, because a lot of times, you know, especially Western audiences, if you're talking about an international event, people do come to something 2 or 3 days late, and they don't know, you know, they don't have the requisite background to get in on a story. And often, you know, too often, I think in the media, you see that a certain level of knowledge is really taken for granted. That's not, you know, that's not always the case. Even with smart, well-informed people, you know, might need to know some basic information. And if you don't, you can skip over it, and you can get right to the latest news. And I know people who did that. I had friends who, you know, got in through the backgrounder, but then, you know, kept the window open for. I had one friend who said he kept it open the entire time that we were updating it, and just refreshed it again and again and again and again, which is, of course, great for time on site.
And I think also the tone that Nick struck in the first one, and that we more or less hold to throughout all of these, kind of no matter what the topic is a good one, because it's sort of like, okay, I'm trying to figure this out along with you, basically. And because the social media that you start to integrate can be so opinionated and so visceral, it's a nice counterbalance. I mean, we generally in our writing have a lot of tone and attitude, but we took a straighter approach to the sort of top part of these because we felt that it was a better balance with the social media that would come below it.
It's definitely not, the voice is definitely not the voice from on high. It's not, and that would be sort of phony to a certain extent, because, you know, I personally was certainly not, and am not, an Egypt expert. What it is just sort of an attempt to, you know, working with readers and working with experts and using the normal tools of reporting, you know, what reporters have always done, try and synthesize some information, get some information, and bring it to the readers in a meaningful and.
Yeah, and I mean, you'd see sentences in there where one of the reporters would literally say, you know, would type out, like, I was incredibly confused as to the factions that were being talked about in the news, so I called these three people. I mean, sort of admitting that reporters are human too, and especially if you're not covering this for years and years, if you haven't been the Cairo bureau chief for the New York Times or whatever, you know, why pretend that you're an expert? Call the experts and sort of be transparent with your readers. They respond to it much better.
Yeah. So this is a really cool project. I know that the person behind it was here at South by this week. What they did is, and I'll just pull out of the presentation for a second to show you it. is that they took both news video and you know, social video recorded by people on the ground from the revolution in Egypt, and they sort of added both contextual notes that they researched and reported, but also tweets from the people at the location at the exact time that you're seeing. So if you look at this clip right here, it's pretty cool. You can see this is a famous sort of clash on this bridge, and you can see that contextual information is coming up as you go along, and you can see people they're bringing in an Al Jazeera reporter who was talking about what was describing the scene in front of her.
I mean, it's so cool. It's like pop-up video, right, in real time for a news event with just random people that they somehow figured out, I guess through geotagging, that they were there on the bridge. It's pretty amazing.
And you can see, so pretty cool stuff. And you can see this is amateur video that they're basing this on, very shaky camera work, and you know, they're pulling up that's a famous photo from the bridge, and really cool project that I liked. And one of the things that we didn't do that we started to do more at Mother Jones is use video, and we're hoping to integrate that into our explainers and our aggregated reporting stuff in the future. So this is something else I wanted to talk about, which you guys have probably seen. I think it's the most trafficked thing ever on ProPublica's site. And actually, it was created by one of their developers as sort of a side project. And then they saw it, and they were like, you need to put this on our site. but the cool thing about it is, which you might not know just from looking at it, so it's tracking the support and opposition to SOPA and PIPA, the IP law reforms that were proposed and then sort of defeated earlier this year. So you could see, if you're following it over the days, you could see sort of the opponents and supporters, the equation shift, and you can see it's a very good visual of party support. You can divide by chamber, but the thing that I really liked about it is that this they weren't just aggregating information about who supported and opposed this. They actually had their reporters making calls to people saying, "Do you support or oppose this?" So it's not that they just like had all this information from other people and they created this cool visual, but you know, they integrated their reporting with this sort of explainery type display, and their reporting was central to it. I mean, a lot of this stuff, you know, a lot of these statements and support and opposition, they probably wouldn't have gotten without sort of forcing the members to make them. You can also see that they integrated campaign finance data to this. You know, on the left, you see that they you'd click to see who got money from which side of the fight. This is another cool thing. I just wanted to talk a little about that going forward in the future and what we'd like to see more of with this stuff. So this is from a video that you may or may not have seen, which takes old Donald Duck cartoons and remixes them and adds Glenn Beck speeches to them. And Donald gets really fired up about fired up by Glenn Beck and really angry about what's happening to his country. It's pretty funny. We can actually watch a little clip of that. You can see that it's HTML5, so The video is not in a little flash box. It's actually part of the page. And it's interacting with the rest of the page. You can see there are footnotes at the bottom. You're going to see this when I play. He's noting all his sources, both video and audio, and he's bringing up sort of contextual Wikipedia information. You can imagine how useful this would be for something, you know, covering a live event, if you can collate in that way and correlate things in that way. So I just want to show you a little bit of this.
Sound.
One of the things I just want to note is that, and one of the things that was really important to us in doing the explainers and still is, especially as a place that values and celebrates original reporting, is citing your sources. You can see how this in this video how well done that is. And one of the things we tried to do, especially because a lot of times with our explainers, we weren't experts on the topic. Sometimes we were. You know, when we covered the Wisconsin Union stuff, Andy Kroll, who works for us, is one of the top reporters on that. And we're based in D.C., so the debt ceiling explainer was sort of right in our wheelhouse. There was a... I think we're getting a little bit of feedback from this here. But it was really important to us to cite where our reporting was coming, where we were aggregating things from when we did aggregate, and then expecting that when other people took our reporting that they'd do the same.
So we have a slew of very serious explainers on the debt ceiling and various parts of the financial crisis and Occupy and bailouts and Egypt and all the Arab Spring stuff and on and on and on. We also started to more recently kind of think about how we could use our own reporting and aggregated stuff from elsewhere to really give our readers some fun, but it's also telling them something at the same time. So I don't know how many of you guys saw this awesome calculator that Slate built where you put in your own income and then saw how long it would take Mitt Romney to, depressingly short amount of time, no matter what your income is. Everybody, I think, it's 98% of America, it's under 2 days. And we've done various calculators before. They beat us to this punch, and we were very admiring and envious of it. So we kind of around the same time took a different approach, and that was, there was all this reporting about how rich Mitt Romney was and where his money come from and how many houses he had and the stamp collection and the cars and the houses and all of this. So we turned it into a quiz that readers could take, and it was sort of pretty much the same as if you did a very straight style story about, the rise of Bain Capital and how he made his money and where it's in the Caymans and all of that, except it's fun. And that was one of the quizzes we've done, but perhaps the absolute finest product that we put out in this was the Newt v. Schrute quiz, which basically you were asked, here's a statement, who said it, Newt Gingrich or Dwight?
Yeah.
Schrute, I don't watch The Office. Dwight Schrute from The Office. And we had a reporter, Tim Murphy in D.C., who's just this hilarious guy and had been putting out this thing called the Daily Newt for weeks, which is just, you know, the latest, craziest thing that Newt Gingrich had done. So we had all of this material, and I think, you know, most of what was in the quiz came from that or our, you know, 30 years of archives on Newt Gingrich. But we also used reporting from elsewhere, and so this quiz went kind of crazy on mostly through social media, and we sort of challenged people in the DC press corps and TV reporters. So, you know, like Ryan Lizza of The New Yorker was like, I only have 45%. And they really kind of helped spread it around, and it was great fun. So we'll just show you a sample question. The average rate of this that
45%.
So here's one question. Men are basically little piglets or pigs. Males are biologically driven to go out and hunt giraffes. Do you remember?
It's definitely Gingrich, I think. Yeah. It's here you can see the answer here.
But backing up to one serious thing that I think we got kind of lost along the way, another thing that came out of this, doing these explainers and kind of sticking ourselves in the middle of some of these things, particularly when it came to Occupy, which we did a lot of really good reporting, and we had the advantage of having folks out in San Francisco where we're based and also in D.C. and New York. So, you know, we had reporters tear gas and rested and kind of along for the whole ride. As a result, we would, while we were doing these explainers, we would be, you know, kind of manning the House Twitter account. And it's sort of a weird thing for journalists to confront, but when you see a lot of disinformation that you either know to be untrue and you suspect could be being used by, you know, either people who want the protests to get more violent or people who, you know, whomever, there could be a lot of different angles into that, you know, what do you do? So we actually spent a lot of time on some key nights sitting there and, like, putting out through social media, that is not true, or this is actually what the mayor just said, or, you know, let me remind you how much a New York City cop makes, or, you know, this is what's going on. Actually, people, there's only been this many people arrested, or whatever. And it was a weird sort of ancillary thing to the explainers, which I think is going to become more and more an issue for all of us, because if you're interacting with your readers, and I think if you're doing social media reporting, and you've seen Andy Carvin do this, sort of, he'll tweet something that someone has said and sort of stick a verify, you know, does anyone know, and sort of try and report it out using Twitter. But you also find yourself in a position of, you know, is it my job to tell the Twitter sphere that this isn't accurate, or that I suspect that that traces back to this source? It's sort of a side note, but an ethical issue that we encountered.
Yeah, one of the good things about the explainer format, when you do have the resources or the ability to put your reporters right in the middle of the action, when Occupy Wall Street was evicted from Zuccotti Park, our reporter Josh Harkinson was, I think, the only reporter, or one of the only reporters, who was actually inside the police lines. There's a big issue after the fact about reporters being penned and it being what was called a frozen zone. He actually got in there, but that meant that he was mostly tweeting. He wasn't able to file right away. And one of the great things about this format is that you can have someone who's not right there on the scene sort of write up some background information about what's going on, and then you can integrate tweets or audio or video up to the minute information from your reporters on the ground, and that's what we did in this case using Storify and some other.
And literally in the case of Gavin Aronson, a reporter in San Francisco, is like, you know, I'm getting arrested basically, and so we're like, all right, now we have to stay up all night, you know, getting on the phone with the mayor of Oakland office and getting him out of jail, and or I've been tear gassed. somebody see if you can go find Gavin. So in general, we sort of just want to go back over these. I think, you know, there are all these different kinds of ways, and it's not like we have the way, but I think if you're going to start to cover a live news event in a kind of comprehensive moment-by-moment way, you really have to give some thought to how long you think this event is going to last, because generally speaking, this is on top of, you know, somebody's other filing or editing or social media requirements, which it pretty much brings us to the bandwidth issue. You know, these were great. They were a huge traffic bump for us. I mean, another thing that we didn't sort of set out to do this, but when we wrote the first "What's Happening in Egypt," as it turns out, that's exactly what people were typing into Google. So it had some nice SEO side effects.
Serendipitous,
yes.
SEO,
yeah.
Side effects.
And it was interesting. I mean, some people at first sort of accused, you know, there's always be the cranks and the trolls are like, you're just doing this for SEO. And then it's like, okay, we have, you know, 200 updates on this story. I think it's a little bit beyond an SEO play. Again, we, you know, just to credit, it's, you know, it's so hard when lots of different organizations are covering it and you can't always sort out who got there first, but as best you can to wade through it and to go back and update it. And, you know, something that we do all the time is someone says that was mine first, like, we check it out, and if it was theirs first, we change the link or we add the link or we sort of say so-and-so was the first to report this. And the same goes for citizen journalists. I don't think you should take their stuff and what they've seen and just sort of as if they're this, you know, treat them as if they're this sort of conduit of information that doesn't deserve. I mean, in some cases, these are the people out there, like, getting beaten up or worse. So, you know, they too deserve credit for the sort of work and effort and danger they're putting themselves into. And I think just, you know, you could use a form like this for all kinds of reporting. I mean, you could use it for celebrity reporting. You could use it, I mean, for almost anything. But I think in general, like, any time your shop can bring either expertise that you already have or, like, go the extra mile to go out and get those experts to inject something that you haven't seen anywhere that's going to hopefully answer the questions that you yourself have, that is a real value add to readers, and they really appreciate it. I mean, we would just get so much inbound social media email thanking us for doing these, including from a lot of reporters, including big name reporters, who are just like, wow, this is really great. This really helped me sort out how I'm going to go talk about this one particular part of the story.
Yeah. There is a great thing that Dan Sinker from Knight quoted yesterday, and he said it was from the ProPublica News Apps team. That they felt a lot of times like they were making an artisanal cheese, that these were all sort of one-off things that they were creating. And that's one of the good things about, you know, developing this and working through it over a period of months, is that we do feel like it's a format that we can continue to use in the future, and something that is not just a one-off.
So on the sort of technology, and we tried to limit this to things that aren't just, you know, particular to our CMS or, like, our, you know, constant need to have more developers. Faster load times, we would suffer this in our own CMS. We would sometimes suffer it with Storify, where it was not always easy to tell where the problem lay. But basically, whenever you've got pages that go on and on and on, and even if you paginate with this much rich media and pulling in all these embeds, it can get very slow. And so when it's a third-party app like Storify, I think one of the things that you need to consider is how much, if it's a super huge news event, how much they're getting slammed. We would sometimes say we're going to do part of it in our CMS to make sure that part of it is there, and then the Storify can load below, and we'd break that up, essentially, just to make sure that, you know, the pipes weren't too clogged. We talked about how we were in this collaboration. I think that's true if you're in a multi-news organization shop, but even if you've just got reporters and editors working in different bureaus and sites, a way that there could be an easier way to sort of integrate people combining, because, you know, you do have to sort of worry about overwriting and just kind of reordering things.
Something that's more like a Google Docs.
Yeah.
Sort of back end.
And same, we kind of imagine that there would be a way to empower trusted users to submit chunks of writing or social media, but you don't want that going, obviously, directly into your system, especially around really sensitive news events. So if there was some sort of bullpen, I don't know if that's quite the right word, a staging server almost, where they could kind of feed you stuff, and then you could kind of sort through it and verify it and decide if you wanted to include it or not, and how to sort of, how to characterize it.
And we also just want to make sure that things that you are embedding Storify are searchable from your own site search engine and also, you know, crawlable and all that. And there are, you know, obviously some SEO worries that you might run into if you're using something that's shareable across multiple sites. It makes it that much easier for people to take your content wholesale. I think we have a little time for questions if people are interested, so just come up to the mic.
Hi, my name is Martha. I'm from the Rainforest Action Network, and my question is a bit more techie. It's around investigative reporting around fake Twitter accounts and IP addresses. That's something that we found has been really beneficial when our campaigners can sort of delve in and find that somebody's, you know, commenting as if an anonymous person, but they're actually, you know, located at a corporation's headquarters. Mm. Or with fake Twitter accounts, you know, they say they're a mom of two with two cats, and they're really a lobbyist. So I'm just curious what kind of in-house sort of tech expertise you have around that kind of investigating.
As far as tech expertise, I would say that we haven't really gone down that road. We more experience the kind of thing that I think is particularly true in Occupy, where there is a lot of false flag bullshit going around Occupy, where people would pretend to be have been hurt by cops, but there'd be really no information, and maybe that happened, maybe it didn't, or and possibly from the other side as well. That there's no real side to that thing. It's like a multi-hydrated beast. But we definitely kind of felt at times that we found things that we really felt that people were not only unintentionally passing on bad information or really old information. Like this happened with the Arab Spring stuff too. Like they show this terrible beating, but actually it was from something that happened a year ago. And if the video doesn't sort of display a date somehow, you know, people get all outraged. And that's what I was talking about earlier, where we sort of felt it was our job to, when we really believe that it was misleading intentionally or otherwise, we'd call it out. If we were just worried about it, we'd try and hold off on retweeting it or certainly incorporating it into our stuff without, at the very least, sort of expressing
doubt.
But it's interesting, you know, I don't know that we've really...
I mean, I would just say as a reporter and as an editor, I think most journalists realize that people lie all the time. I think one of my friends in D.C., or one of my colleagues, I guess, to define journalism as the practice of standing outside of rooms waiting for people to come out and lie to you. So I think you can't do the job without a healthy skepticism about everything from Twitter accounts to what someone's telling you on the phone to who someone's claiming to be. And that's why, we've always really valued fact-checking at our organization and employ people specifically for that purpose.
And I think when we would sort of recite either via Twitter itself or in explainers or in another format, folks who weren't on our payroll or weren't kind of traditional accredited journalist types, we would kind of go the extra mile to figure out who of these people seems reliable, does somebody who's been covering this closer on the ground, does Andy Carvin know who this person, is this person deemed a reliable source, even if it's a source with a point of view? I mean, I don't think you should ding someone just for the point of view, but you need to know what it is.
Yeah, and we try to always identify that sort of thing.
Hi, Andrew Mills from Medill. I wonder how you manage this from sort of a human resources point of view inside your newsroom. Mm. So, take the Egyptian revolution example. Is it Nick and Nick is doing everything from start to finish on this, or do you assign three reporters and an editor to this, or how does that work? Because I could see this getting really overwhelming.
Oh yeah, it got really overwhelming. I mean, often they were sort of spearheaded by one kind of reporter-editor team with others joining in. When they were the huge, multifaceted events, the kind of updates might be credited to Nick or Sid or, any number of the reporters. But some of them would come, via the editor saying, hey, I just saw this, let's check it out, and if it seems to be check out, then let's stick that in as an update. But it did. It became a serious resource issue for us. We had close to 100 of these. Maybe that's a little exaggerated, but there were a lot of them. And like I said, at one point we were like, and then people started expecting them on everything. And then, why aren't you doing this topic? And it was like, oh God, it's not because of that we don't think it's worthy or we don't want to report this, we don't want to talk about Solyndra or we don't want to do this. Just our staff is exhausted and we can't really take on anymore. So I think, Storify helped that a little bit. It was a little less labor intensive on the back end. But it's an issue that we struggle with.
Yeah, I just want to give you guys a little peek into our back end just to get an idea of the different people involved with this. So you can see a lot of them are Sid and I, but there are a lot of different names in there. Monica, who's Claire's co-editor, Laura McClure, who's another editor. And there are Ashley Bates, Tim Murphy, who's one of my fellow reporters, Sam Baldwin, David Korn. So Kate Shepard, everyone's getting involved with this at one point or another for the course of, you can see just how many times it was revised. I mean, it's pretty incredible, right?
Yeah.
So, yes, it did get overwhelming.
I think we tended to kind of do it in pods. Like this project became a sort of pod of the people you see there when we did Occupy and Union, thanks. That would be a sort of different set of reporters and editors. But it was all hands on deck, and that's not even talking about the fact, we have a social media intern who's very good, but that person goes home at 5, and we do not call our interns in to work late. So that meant that especially for Occupy, we would have reporters and editors manning the Twitter feed until 3 a.m.
And especially with an explainer, the tweets were really, really important in driving traffic, saying,
we updated this with this information, you know, find out more. I tried to do that every time that we updated the Egypt Explainer significantly. So,
yeah.
So, go ahead.
Hi, John Richards, NewsOlive.com. Wanted to find out, how do you guys feel about, you know, Mother Jones has sort of reached this hipness factor where people want to be associated with Mother Jones? Is, oh, we're serious about reading news now, as far as from the reader's point of view. How do you feel about aggregators embedding Mother Jones and using your content? With credit going back.
Yeah, well, there's, you know, and again, there's yet another panel facing that issue immediately following this one. There's so many different kinds of aggregation, right? I mean, the thing that we absolutely hate is when someone just yanks our story without our permission and sticks it on their site. And that we get, you know, very tough about. And, you know, to take this down immediately or the lawyers get involved kind of levels. You know, but we have a good relationship with HuffPo. They sometimes run full stories of ours. They also run kind of links out to us. You know, we get blogged about with big block quotes all the time. I think it's really, does someone have something to add? Like, if Kevin Drum writes something and Felix Salmon then goes off on that, or vice versa, that's all part of the mix, right? I think it's when you're basically taking someone's content, sticking at best like a topic sentence on it, and sort of ensuring, especially if you're a bigger organization, that all that traffic will go to you. That's just not cool. So,
how accessible are you guys for getting permission for this?
It's sort of on a case by case basis. You know, we let people, and it depends on the story, and often how long we've already had it on the site. So, I mean, there's no sort of hard and fast rule.
So you guys do a great job of covering, you know, stories that are in the moment in a different way, and I'm wondering if there's a way that you're using the techniques that you've talked about here and the tactics that you've used here for stories that aren't out there yet, mm-hmm. sort of reveal mm-hmm. what the next big story ought to be, or just an untold story that you have access to that others don't. Is there a connection between what you've been telling us here and identifying something yeah. new?
I do think that that's a really big part of our identity is telling those sorts of stories and part of our brand. And I'd like to see us, you know, bring this into that more. Mostly because of luck, I guess, and just the things that you know we in DC were personally interested in. We were on Egypt pretty early. You know, I think that the Explainer started January 23rd, the earliest mainstream news organizations to really jump on it, I think, were in January 25th. You know, a lot of that. You know, when something's in the moment like that, sometimes it's hard to predict, you know, when something's going to blow up. But I'm trying to think of if there's...
Yeah, I don't know that we've used this form so much for that, but it's a good point, and I think we should experiment with that. I mean, when they first started, it was sort of that, if you need to catch up. And we would often sort of say, do you need to catch up on Egypt? Read this. But I can see us doing a variation of that to sort of break something down, like, you don't know about this, but you're going to hear yeah. about it later.
One of those that we did do that I just thought of that I think exactly matches what you're looking for is, I mentioned Andy Kroll earlier, who's a great reporter. He covers a lot of labor issues and economy issues. And he did a great explainer that he's continued to update on this scandal surrounding Scott Walker and campaign finance rules, or it's not really campaign finance, it's more like the state equivalent of the Hatch Act, which prevents people in state government jobs from politicking. And it was exactly that pitch. It was, you haven't heard about this, and you know this hasn't really made national news, but it's been a lot in the news in Wisconsin. You will hear about it when the recall campaign really heats up. You know, he did a great job of that. But I really appreciate you bringing that up, and yeah. I think we're gonna.
And we did a really interesting Prezi, which is a kind of display kind of video device on the Republican Governors Association and how they move money kind of through, I mean, they wipe the fingerprints off the money, I think is the euphemism that was of choice. And it's a really kind of complicated thing about how they move it sort of through different states and different things to bring it back to typically a gubernatorial candidate that they want to get elected. So we used it for that, and that wasn't a story that people had really ever heard about. Yeah.
Thanks so much, guys. I think we're
Yeah,
we're
thanks,
out of
guys,
time.
And thanks to the staff and the volunteers of South By.
Yeah, thank you so much.